Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, April 22nd, and we're bringing you a particularly packed edition today, the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. I'm Maya, and as always, I'm here to cut through the noise with Alex.
And good morning to you. We've been meticulously curating this one. Think of it as a medieval manuscript, each theme a richly illuminated page revealing deeper connections across seemingly disparate fields. Today, we're starting with investing, but not just how to invest, Maya, but why history's best investors succeeded.
Two things stand out. We're talking about lessons from market masters that still hold water, even after centuries. But that's just the beginning. Ever wonder if the current energy crisis is less about oil prices and more about a centuries-old power play?
It's a bigger game than many realize. Then we'll pivot to AI, and specifically, the cybersecurity vulnerabilities being exposed right now. Did you know the number of AI-driven cyberattacks has tripled in the last 6 months?
Tripled? Honestly, that's terrifying. And after that, we're looking at ancient economies. Believe it or not, they hold a surprisingly dark mirror to our modern debt cycles.
And to finish, we're diving into Asia's economic resilience, and naturally, how AI is going to reshape that future. I wasn't expecting to find these patterns so clearly aligned.
You always dig up the hidden gems, Alex. Let's get started. First up, investing through the ages. Winston Churchill reportedly had a turnover rate comparable to Citadel. Let's talk about investing legends, or maybe investing fallibility, and what their stories tell us about navigating today's market.
It's a fascinating paradox, isn't it? The assumption is brilliance in one field translates to success everywhere, but the Gillian Tett piece makes a powerful case that adaptability and discipline are just as important, if not more so. The context, the sheer noise of the market, all play a massive role.
Discipline, right? Churchill's trading, as described, sounds less like strategic portfolio construction and more like a very well-funded, emotionally driven hobby. High turnover is euphemism for lots of bad decisions.
The implication runs deeper. The margin trading exacerbates that. It's a classic example of how even substantial resources don't insulate you from poor judgment. Newton's South Sea bubble experience is equally instructive. Initial gains, followed by a 40% loss upon reinvestment at the peak. Even he fell victim to the mania.
The madness of men, as Newton himself put it. But he did time the exit reasonably well. Is that luck or a function of his analytical mind recognizing something was unsustainable?
I think it's a combination. Tett points out it wasn't purely luck, it was recognizing the peak, even if he then succumbed to the temptation to re-enter. That illustrates the emotional trap, though this time it's different fallacy. The takeaway isn't that brilliant minds are immune, but that even they require safeguards.
So genius isn't enough. What about Keynes? He's often held up as the investing gold standard.
Keynes is interesting because he adapted. Toby Nangle identifies his shift from high-frequency trading to longer-term holdings as critical to his success. Starting with under 6 month holding periods, then moving to 7 years plus. That's a remarkable stylistic evolution.
A stylistic evolution that sounds a lot like stop chasing shiny objects and actually build a portfolio.
And replicability is the challenge. The pre-1980s information landscape was fundamentally different. He had informational advantages that would now be illegal. Plus, the outperformance 5% above UK stocks for 25 years is impressive, but it's hard to isolate skill from context.
Context being a huge factor. The GDP adjustments mentioned in the article are a really important point. Comparing wealth solely on CPI-linked figures misses a massive part of the picture.
It's about relative performance, not absolute gains. And it's a reminder that success is rarely linear. Consider Darwin. Impressive 8.6% annualized growth over 42 years, but how much of that was inherited wealth versus investment acumen?
The starting capital question. It throws everything off. A good starting point versus a bad one fundamentally changes the game.
The pattern is clear, then you have figures like Turner, operating as a fixed income arbitrage specialist in the early 19th century. Sophisticated strategies weren't limited to modern institutions. It suggests that financial innovation isn't new, it's just more accessible now.
Accessible and significantly more crowded. That increased scrutiny, the ability to adapt, that's the key, isn't it?
So here's the picture, it's incredibly difficult. The AlphaCore wealth advisory discussion highlights the need to constantly reevaluate. Dick Pfister's AlphaCore model, core alpha generators surrounded by beta, is a good illustration of building resilience across cycles.
AlphaCore, which translated from finance speak, means don't put all your eggs in one basket.
That's a fair translation. And it speaks to the cyclical nature of markets. Pfister's point about new vintage years in private markets being attractive right now, avoiding GPs saturated with capital, emphasizes that cyclical view. It's not buy and hold forever.
So where does that leave us with modern markets, specifically given the macro, geopolitics, AI, blockchain lens we're using?
I think the lessons from these historical figures are particularly relevant now because we're seeing convergence of multiple manias. AI, blockchain, even certain geopolitical narratives are generating bubbles. The availability entrepreneurs that Eric Thornburg highlights are driving that, injecting ideas into the public consciousness.
A polite way of saying hype merchants.
An accurate description. The city's church case, for example, the DOJ rushing to prosecute under the FACE Act, feels like a similar dynamic. A symbolic reversal of priorities driven by online outrage.
And that's where the online aspect is crucial. Harmeet Dhillon's activity on X influencing policy decisions is unprecedented, as Quinta Juresic notes. A civil rights division head driven by Twitter trends.
It's a feedback loop. The same dynamics we saw with the South Sea bubble, the collective madness, are amplified by social media. That's why understanding historical financial absurdities is so vital. The South Sea bubble wasn't unique, it's a recurring pattern.
So less Newtonian physics and more ecological systems, a complex web of interconnected factors prone to sudden shifts and unexpected consequences. The market isn't a rational actor, it's a swarm.
The key isn't predicting the shifts, that's impossible, but building a resilient portfolio that can weather them. Prioritizing doing your work, reinvesting time in the market. That consistent effort, as Tet mentioned.
The ultimate lesson being that even geniuses aren't immune, but adaptability and discipline are. And that emotional biases are a constant threat regardless of IQ.
It's a telling detail. And in the current environment, that means a focus on risk management, diversification, the Elfiker approach, and a long-term perspective. Don't chase the latest meme, build a foundation.
What specific indicator should listeners be watching in the next week to gauge this?
Keep an eye on the Altman AI fundraising activity, specifically their next major funding round and the conditions attached. If they're able to raise capital without significant governance concessions, that signals continued market exuberance and a willingness to overlook potential risks. The date to watch is May 1st, when reports of the next valuation round are expected to be released.
Right. Exuberance and a lack of due diligence. Which nicely sets up our next topic, geopolitics and energy, the Iran conflict's global impact. Because if there's one thing historical bubbles teach us, it's that even rational actors can get caught up in irrational narratives. So let's be blunt, the US isn't trying to resolve the Iran conflict, they're trying to manage a permanent state of low-level instability. Is that too cynical?
Not at all. The framing from Trump's administration, as detailed in the reports, points to a new navigational order in the Middle East. It's not about a return to a pre-conflict status quo. It's about accepting a recurring pressure tactic from Iran, specifically leveraging actions like blockading the Strait of Hormuz. Dana Strahl's analysis is critical here. It's a card they'll consistently play.
A card, right? And everyone's pretending they're surprised when they play it. What's the long game for the US if resolution is off the table?
It appears to be maximum pressure, deliberately provoking Iranian reactions to gauge internal divisions. Terry Haynes notes the phase strategy is less about military objectives and more about exploiting vulnerabilities. This is underpinned by Trump's understanding of market dynamics, as Rachman and Strahl pointed out, recognizing the economic consequences are a tool themselves.
Economic consequences for everyone, though. It's not like this blockade is a victimless exercise.
Worth noting, Michael Singh highlights the domestic political risk for the U.S. Unlike the Iraq War, a sustained closure of the Strait of Hormuz creates a unique pressure point, rising costs of essential goods fracturing Republican support. The Trump administration isn't oblivious to this.
They're playing a game of chicken with their own base, fueled by oil prices. Wonderful.
It's more nuanced than that. The reports suggest Iran is successfully employing asymmetric warfare. Small attacks, closures of the Strait, missile strikes, all designed to impose economic and political pressure. Jessica Genor's observation that they're perceiving this as a success is key. It's driving a doubling down on brinkmanship.
A success that includes flight reductions and manufacturing slowdowns, apparently. Doug Christner's conversation pointed out real economic impact. Is anyone seriously trying to de-escalate, or are we just accepting slow-motion disruption?
The current truce extensions, as analyzed by Wendy Benjaminson, aren't necessarily policy shifts, but managing market expectations. Trump's communication patterns are anticipated. It's a calculated strategy, even if predictable. The stalemate obscures the phase pressure, designed to reveal internal Iranian divisions.
Revealing divisions by making life harder for everyone. It feels inefficient.
The efficiency isn't the point, it seems. The longer-term effect, according to Genor, may be demonstrating Iran's leverage over the global economy, specifically through the Strait of Hormuz. The disruption to shipping and resulting fuel scarcity is the goal in itself.
A controlled burn of the global supply chain. That's optimistic if you're an Iranian strategist.
It's a strategic outcome, not necessarily an optimistic one. China's role is critical here. They are uniquely positioned to influence Iran, but their current strategy of observation isn't detrimental to their interests. They could intervene more forcefully, particularly concerning the Strait if desired, according to the Bloomberg Audio Studios contributors.
Convenient observation. What's China's actual exposure here?
Substantial. Their reliance on hydrocarbon transit through the Strait makes them particularly vulnerable. This vulnerability is, according to Helen Thompson, even greater than their dependence on the Malacca Strait due to their investments in Iranian energy.
And what about the smaller players? The ones who don't have the leverage to observe strategically?
Countries like Indonesia and the Philippines are uniquely caught between economic stimulus and currency stability due to their energy import dependence. This creates a rock and a hard place scenario for their central banks, as highlighted in the reports. They're facing a difficult balancing act.
A balancing act that, if disrupted, could lead to what?
Regional crises, for one. The commodities market, as Pushkin, Martin, and Armstrong discussed, is already experiencing turbulence. Asia is facing a full-blown energy crisis, with diesel shortages and price volatility in Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia.
Diesel shortages. That's not a headline you want to see.
It's a symptom of a larger crisis, and it's expected to intensify westward with the summer driving season. Russell Hardy's observation that this is the largest energy crisis in his four-decade career underscores the severity.
4 decades. That's a statement. And what about the broader financial markets? Are they even paying attention?
There's a disconnect between commodity market turbulence and broader financial stability, potentially due to expectations of a swift resolution in the Strait. But that simplification, as attendees at the FT Commodities Global Summit noted, ignores the difficulty of accurately pricing geopolitical uncertainty.
Everyone's hoping for a miracle while ignoring the building storm.
Essentially, commodities trading houses are in a paradoxical situation, making substantial profits due to the disruption but recognizing the dangerous implications. Rob Armstrong's observation that they're making money hand over fist because of relocation demand highlights this.
Oh, wonderful. We're incentivizing the crisis.
The current expectation is a prolonged disruption lasting until around 2030. A scar on the system, according to the summit attendees, due to the logistical challenges of redistributing 12 million barrels of oil a day.
2030. That's 9 years of maximum pressure on everyone's wallets.
The regional impact is deeply uneven. Asia is currently experiencing a full-blown crisis, while broader markets remain largely unconcerned. Specific countries like Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia are facing proper shortages rationing, yet this isn't reflected in global benchmark prices.
So localized pain obscured by global averages.
The logistical complexity will intensify, shifting the burden from east to west as inventories are depleted. Traders are currently moving oil from Western stockpiles to Asia, but summer driving season will reverse that flow, creating a huge logistical nightmare.
It sounds like a really expensive game of Tetris.
It is, in a way. The U.S. military is mortgaging its future security by depleting missile stockpiles, as reported, creating readiness gaps for future crises. The $1.5 trillion Pentagon budget request reflects increased global tensions.
And that budget equates to roughly $5,000 per household annually for a decade. A hidden tax, basically.
The data tells a story. Justin Wolfer's analysis shows the $600 billion increase represents a $50,000 cost shift to the American public over 10 years. The fact that 2027 and 2028 oil price futures rose upon the war's declaration, while falling on news of peace, signifies markets aren't reacting to immediate disruptions but to prolonged instability.
And Iran has demonstrated control of the Strait of Hormuz, a strategic loss for the U.S., according to Wolfer's.
Stepping back, this, coupled with the discovery of interdependencies, suggests isolating countries often reveals weaknesses and creates new power dynamics, as seen with rare earth minerals.
So this isn't about winning or losing, it's about who can tolerate the most discomfort.
In a very real sense, yes. Christine Lagarde's warning of double uncertainty is a more nuanced framework than simple inflation predictions. Jumani Salihin specifically identifies Europe's dependence on energy imports as a causal link.
A causal link that means they're particularly screwed.
In the short term, likely. But it's also important to consider the long term. The U.S. shale oil boom is nearing stagnation, forcing a reassessment of long-term energy security.
The energy independence dream is fading.
The reports suggest it's not just geological, but tied to finance and technology. Trump's rhetoric, including threats of total destruction, functions as a geopolitical weapon, destabilizing the situation. Even if strategic motives exist, the language itself is inflammatory.
$50,000, a decade of depleted stockpiles, a stalled shale boom. Honestly, I'm not sure what the endgame is here.
That's the frustrating part. The attacks on Qatari LNG facilities demonstrate the existential nature of the conflict for Gulf states, something often overlooked. The U.S. conflict with Iran may inadvertently incentivize those states to reassess their alignment, potentially shifting closer to China. And I genuinely don't know how that plays out. The entire system is built on a level of reliable contract and predictable outcomes that just isn't there anymore. And that's terrifying because it means any calculation you make is fundamentally unstable.
So even if this war ends tomorrow, we're looking at years of unpredictable energy costs, geopolitical realignments, and a lot of scrambling. Which, incidentally, is creating a huge demand for AI-powered predictive analytics in the energy sector. That's a conversation for next time, I think. We were talking earlier about the increasing velocity of technological change, specifically how quickly these large language models are moving from research projects to embedded components. Feels relevant, doesn't it? Like we're building the plane while it's already in the air, and now someone's handing us the blueprints, written in code we barely understand.
Something to flag here, that acceleration is precisely what's fueling this new wave of cybersecurity risk. The Versal breach in February, stemming from a compromised context AI tool, isn't an isolated incident. It's a clear demonstration of AI-adjacent supply chain vulnerabilities. Companies are rushing to integrate these tools, creating new dependencies and expanding the attack surface.
Expanding the attack surface is polite. It feels more like demolishing the existing walls and hoping for the best. But it's not just the tools themselves, is it? Anthropic's Mythos is showing us that the existing code we already have is riddled with problems. A 27-year-old bug in OpenBSD discovered by an AI, that's just embarrassing.
It's more than embarrassing, it's a paradigm shift. Previously, finding these vulnerabilities required arcane computer science and significant time investment. Mythos bypasses that expertise barrier, reducing the time to discovery from an average of 847 days 8 years ago to within a single day. This collapse in the discovery to exploitation window is what Jessica Mendoza and Robert McMillan are calling Bugmageddon.
Bugmageddon? I'm stealing that. Seriously? But 847 days to a day? That's terrifying. It's like we went from slow-motion geological processes to a meteor strike. And Anthropic is only giving access to 50 corporations. That screams we know this is dangerous.
The limited release isn't solely a PR strategy, though that component certainly exists. It's a deliberate attempt to manage risk and accelerate vulnerability remediation. The concern, as reported, is that Mythos has already slipped its bonds, meaning it's likely already in the hands of malicious actors or soon will be. Boards are requesting detailed cybersecurity plans, recognizing the heightened threat environment.
Existing software is potentially compromised faster. New software is probably also compromised faster, and we're all scrambling to catch up. Robert McMillan compared it to white decay. Is that a fair comparison?
It's analogous in the sense of a widespread, urgent need for proactive patching, but crucially different. Y2K had a defined endpoint and a clear fix. These AI-discovered vulnerabilities are continuous, potentially limitless. The focus is shifting from specialized security expertise to rapid response, but even that's being complicated by the rise of AI-created software and agentic systems.
Agentic systems? Okay, now you're officially keeping me up at night. We're not just patching old code. We're preparing to defend against software written by AI, potentially attacking software also written by AI.
We can trace that further. McMillan argues that the focus on legacy code bugs is actually overshadowing the greater systemic risk of attacks on these AI-driven systems. It's a wave that currently isn't being appreciated enough.
Which is wildly predictable, frankly. We're always reacting to the last crisis instead of anticipating the next one. Anthropic's framing itself as a responsible AI company feels less like altruism and more like acknowledging that they've opened Pandora's box.
It's a pragmatic response, born from recognizing the problem early. It's prompted boards and security teams to proactively plan and mitigate, mirroring the response during Y2K. However, the absence of a final solution is the defining characteristic of this crisis. It's not about fixing the code, it's about continuous adaptation.
Continuous adaptation to a problem with an unknown upper limit, potentially wielded by actors with increasingly sophisticated tools and built on a foundation of vendor dependencies we don't fully understand. What keeps me up at night is the idea that we're focusing on patching the holes in a sinking ship while someone else is building a fleet of submarines. And honestly, it all feels a bit like a prelude to reevaluating the fundamental economic models that rely on increasingly complex and fragile digital infrastructure. So if debt existed before money, does that mean everything we think we know about the origins of economic hardship is wrong?
That's precisely the challenge Amanda H. Podney lays out, tracing debt back to 2450 BCE Mesopotamia with King Enmetna's laws. It fundamentally reorders the historical narrative. The standard model assumes barter preceded debt, a kind of gradual evolution. These cuneiform texts demonstrate debt was intrinsic to the earliest urban civilizations, almost a prerequisite.
Intrinsic, right? Like needing a coffee before starting work. Except instead of caffeine, it was clay tablets and the threat of enslavement.
A slightly more severe dependency, yes. And it wasn't just a few isolated instances. Gillian Tett highlights the recurring nature of these debt cancellations. Hammurabi alone issued around 30 releases over 300 years, continuing a practice begun centuries earlier. It wasn't about innovation, it was maintenance.
Maintenance. Okay, that's a helpful frame. So kings weren't being generous, they were preventing a revolt.
There's a signal here, the debt primarily targeted debts of need of the poor. Rulers like Hammurabi strategically freed individuals from debt slavery to restore the labor force, particularly essential for the palace economy. Letting merchants accumulate too much control through debt created a critical labor shortage.
A king's legitimacy was tied to how well he managed other people's IOUs.
Consider this, Hammurabi enacting releases at the start of his reign wasn't just economic policy, it was calculated political theater, establishing an image of kindness and adhering to expected royal behavior. It's a really specific causal mechanism, merchant overreach leading to labor shortages necessitating royal intervention.
Interesting. But what about the lenders? Surely they weren't thrilled.
They weren't, but the system was designed to mitigate that. Officials verified claims to prevent fraud, and lenders often benefited from simultaneous tax relief. More crucially, the economy operated within a worldview where economics, politics, and religion were inseparable. Fear of divine justice, specifically from shamans, encouraged compliance and likely dampened outright predatory lending.
Divine punishment instead of the SEC. I can see how that simplify regulation. Though Amanda H. Podney predicted a modern debt cancellation program would be gamed, lenders adjusting rates to account for future forgiveness.
That's the core problem. Robin Wigglesworth cautions against direct comparisons because one person's debt is another's asset, and anticipating future interventions inevitably changes behavior. We already see that dynamic with risk pricing in various loan markets.
Which means the clay tablets weren't just symbolic, they were literally breaking the evidence. A really early form of record destruction to enforce the decree, preventing lenders from fraudulently claiming the debts were still outstanding.
And it's not just about fraud. The linguistic detail of amargi, meaning return to mother, reframes it as a social act, explicitly linked to freeing families and restoring units of labor. This wasn't solely about finances.
So if we fast forward to today, with central banks quietly inflating asset prices to reduce real debt burdens, Gillian Tett's point about subtle debt reduction, we're essentially recreating a king destroying the tablets, but with a less physical method. The biggest implication, the cycle continues. The winners are always those who hold power, whether it's a king or the institutions controlling monetary policy, and the losers are the ones holding the debt when the edict comes down. And that, I suspect, will break next, trust in the institutions managing that debt.
There's a signal here, it raises fundamental questions about what constitutes economic stability and the increasingly fragile boundary between monetary policy and political legitimacy, especially as AI and blockchain challenge traditional financial record keeping.
Everyone thought geopolitical risk meant hitting the sell button on Asia. Turns out the opposite is often true. We're diving into Asia's resilience and the surprising power driving it, AI.
Worth noting, over the last two decades, balanced Asia equity and fixed income portfolios have outperformed global equivalents, and historical data suggests a counterintuitive pattern. Markets nearly recovering initial losses following events like the recent Iran conflict, with positive returns within 12 months. It challenges the knee-jerk reaction to global instability.
Nearly recovering feels like a euphemism when you consider the actual impact, but the point stands. So if not panic, what is happening?
The IMF's tone shift in early 2026 is key. They acknowledge solid tech export performance, but flag Middle East risks. The real story isn't just despite the shocks, but because of Asia's role in the technology supply chain. Specifically, their central position in the AI infrastructure.
Right. The US designs a lot of AI, but it's critically dependent on Asia for building it. Chips from Korea and Taiwan, assembly in Southeast Asia, data infrastructure in Singapore. It's a reversal of expectations. AI leadership doesn't automatically equate to control of the entire value chain.
Stepping back, that physical infrastructure offers productive capital spending opportunities and innovation. We're seeing a structural opportunity unfold here, and Asian emerging markets are uniquely positioned to benefit.
Okay, so AI is good. But even good things have problems. What's keeping policymakers up at night?
Structural reforms. Labor market challenges, youth employment, AI skill mismatches are crucial. The IMF is urging targeted fiscal support and increased domestic demand in China to address this, and deeper regional integration.
Deeper integration, which sounds nice, until you remember that China's domestic demand could suddenly decide to buy a lot of autonomous delivery robots, leading to a global lithium shortage, prompting a trade war over battery materials, and ultimately a world where dinner is only delivered by drones with vaguely menacing cargo holds.
While that's a specific scenario, your point about operational data is astute. Autonomous delivery penetration, currently below 1%, is projected to reach 10% by 2035. The competitive advantage isn't the tech itself, it's off the shelf, but platforms like DoorDash and Uber leveraging their existing data assets and network effects.
So scale wins. Which brings us to a broader point, Asia isn't just building the future, it's increasingly running it.
Considering the projected growth in autonomous delivery and the need for structural reforms, it will be critical to watch the investments in alternative energy and the speed of digital infrastructure development across the region between now and 2030. Will Asia's infrastructure be able to handle the computational demand? That, more than anything, will determine long-term economic growth.
Stepping back from Churchill's turnover rate to Hammurabi's debt releases, it feels like today's conversation wasn't about disparate events, but about recurring patterns of systemic stress. We explored how financial markets, geopolitics, technology, and even ancient economic practices are fundamentally linked by human behavior and a consistent inability to learn from history. It wasn't about predicting what will happen, but recognizing how things tend to unfold when complex systems encounter pressure.
We can trace that further. I think Gillian Tett's observation about anthropology illuminating finance is key here. We're seeing a confluence of mania's energy, AI investment, maybe even a nascent autonomous delivery bubble, all fueled by narratives that often bypass rational assessment. The $1.5 trillion Pentagon budget, the doubling down in Iran, these aren't isolated incidents. They're symptoms of a global system recalibrating under immense strain, a kind of controlled burn of inherent inefficiencies. The city's church prosecution case, Harmeet Dhillon's insights into legal challenges, they hint at the cracks forming as these pressures mount.
And the AI layer adds a new dimension of urgency. The speed at which vulnerabilities like the Anthropic bug are being discovered, 847 days average to now less than a day, is genuinely alarming. It's like building the plane while it's in the air, with the structural integrity constantly being questioned. We've spent the day meticulously curating these data points, and the underlying message is stark. Our existing infrastructure is increasingly fragile, and legacy code is a systemic risk.
The data tells a story. To extend that analogy, the global economy resembles a tidal estuary. Incoming tides of capital and technological innovation clash with the existing sediment of geopolitical tensions and historical debt cycles. The energy supply chain, particularly China's reliance on the Strait of Hormuz, represents a crucial constriction point. Asia's resilience, driven by its central role in AI infrastructure, offers a temporary buffer, but also exposes it to unique shocks which we'll need to anticipate. The IMF's shifting tone in 2026 will be critical, hinting at a more overt acknowledgement of these structural issues.
So if this is a system under stress, what are the key indicators to watch? Altman's fundraising activity on May 1st feels like a bellwether. Can capital continue to flow without governance concessions? And the Middle East disruption projected to 2030 seems inevitable, requiring a 9-year period of maximum pressure on wallets, as Russell Hardy articulated.
And beyond those, Asia's ability to manage the computational demands of future growth is paramount. It's not just about growth rates, it's about the capacity to sustain that growth. We're entering a period where access to computational resources and the cybersecurity to protect them will be increasingly decisive. This convergence of multiple manias and systemic vulnerabilities, it feels like we're past the point of simply doing your work and entering a phase of active risk management.
It's unsettling but also clarifying. We're seeing the counterintuitive pattern of ancient debt cycles repeating, even as we build increasingly sophisticated technologies. It's not this time it's different, it's recognizing that the underlying human dynamics remain constant.
Something to flag here, perhaps the most valuable takeaway is the importance of adaptability and discipline. As Darwin's 8.6% annualized growth over 42 years demonstrated, success isn't about being the smartest person in the room, but about consistently navigating the cycles, building a foundation and safeguarding against impulsive decisions.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow, continuing to cut through the noise and hopefully illuminate a few more richly illuminated pages revealing deeper connections.